Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020.
Lecture 20, delivered on April 8th.
When we go into this idea of valuing the stock of a company, there are different ways that we can do it. Now, I've been addressing common stocks so far, but I need to go back, reel back a little bit, and say, well, there's another kind of equity. It's called preferred stock. Now, preferred stock is it's almost like you're a bond, in the sense that there's a fixed payment. It's a dividend, and it's paid after the debt holders are paid. But generally speaking, the preferred dividend is paid before a common dividend would ever be paid. And so you want to keep that in mind, that there's this preferred stock out there. It's sort of like something that you would buy if you want a relatively safe, pretty safe investment, a fixed income security. And unlike a bond, this payment, this dividend, goes on forever because the preferred stock is an ownership of the corporation. And so if the company goes on, then this preferred stock goes on. It's a very simple formula for pricing preferred stock. All you do, let me show you one. PCX... ...1.5% cumulative preferred. Now what this says, par value, let me put par value, $40 per share. Nothing big about that. All we're saying is that forever, once every year, this company will pay 1.5% of $40. The more or less the upshot there is that this will go on forever. So every year you'll get 1.5% of $40, which would be $40 plus 20 cents, 60 cents. So for every share that you own of preferred stock, you get 60 cents every year, forever. Now, some preferred stock has some kind of hidden thing in it. Well, we can convert this sometime in the future to common stock. But at its raw heart, this is just a fixed income instrument. Back in the day, this was really popular stuff because, I mean, a company could sell this and it would be picked up by all kinds of different institutional investors that wanted safe investments with a fixed income, and you didn't ever have to roll it over. See, if you've got bonds, even though you get a fixed coupon every year, or twice every year, you still, when the bond matures, you have to take that money and reinvest it. With this, it just sits there forever and ever and ever. Now, one thing that's interesting, see this term, this word cumulative. If the preferred is cumulative, that means, one, that if the company isn't able to pay this dividend in a year, then it has to pay that dividend and the subsequent dividend the next year. And every year that it doesn't pay a dividend, those dividends accumulate, and the company has to get those taken care of before it can ever pay a dividend to common stock. Preferred stock is a residual claim, but it has a higher claim at the residual level than the common stock does. So if a company doesn't pay its cumulative preferred dividend, it cannot pay its regular common stock shareholders, which makes it even more attractive to an investor because you can't give any candy to anyone before you pay us, the preferred shareholders. in recent times, it has lost its popularity. I mean, there was a time when that would be, well, there's a way to have an ownership stake in a company, but yet have a certain known dividend every year forever. And it's lost its luster, and there are various reasons why this has happened. But you still see preferred stock in some kinds of businesses. For example, I was going through these charts of stocks that different companies have issued and what's outstanding, and I found that some real estate types of companies still have preferred stock that they issue. They raise equity capital, not by doing IPOs and common stock seasoned offerings. They sell preferred stock. It just seems to be sort of a thing in that industry. But it is not that usual out there in more diverse types of companies. Sometimes you'll see on the books of a company, in the income statement, they will talk about the number of shares outstanding in that equity owner's equity section. And what that you'll see a listing for there's the common stock, additional paid in capital, and then there will be this line with preferred stock. Sometime long ago in the past, this company did issue preferred stock, and there it is sitting on the books, just parked there. So it's still out there, and you'll see it even if companies don't issue it anymore. You'll see that some companies at some time in the past did so, and that fossil is still parked on their books and is reported as such as part of the total stockholders' equity. So there you are. There's a kind of odd thing. Now, the interesting part about this animal is that it is very easy to price. Essentially, you use a no-growth dividend model. The price of a share of preferred stock right now is going to be just that flat dividend divided by the discount rate for that kind of security based upon market conditions. So, for example, in this case right here, this company has a 1.5% coupon on this PCX preferred it issued at some time in the past. Well, let's say that the market says, right now, we would think that that preferred stock should pay only a 1.2% dividend. I mean, this is so safe. Why would we want 1.5? But you're getting it, so we can say, all right, well, the price would then be that 1.2% dividend, which would be 1.2%. Well, on top, the dividend is 60 cents a share, 0.60 divided by this market assessment, 0.012. And remember, this is actual math, so you've got to use the actual number itself. And that will equal, if I can do this, seriously, I was so off my game tonight. Come on. This is like skiing behind a rowboat. There we go. Okay. Now, 1.2% dividend on that. Of course, someone here could help me and do that calculation real quick and save me some embarrassment trying to find my calculator in this mess. Okay. 0.60 divided by 0.012. You'll see that this is actually going to have a price that's higher than the par value because the company, because this dividend is better than the market expects, the stock, this preferred stock, will sell at a premium to its par value, more than $40. On the other hand, suppose the market said, well, you know, right now, this is kind of a risky endeavor. This company in general and this preferred stock might not be paying for a couple of years. So let's say that the market says it should be 2% instead of 1.5%. So in this case, you would take the 60 cent actual dividend, 0.060. This is really hard to write this way. I never quite appreciate it. Divided by 0.02. And if you did that, this stock would sell 0.60 divided by 0.02 would come out to be $30. So in this case, the stock, this preferred stock will sell at a discount to the par. That's $40, not 40% right there. Jeez. Okay, one last time. Suppose the market says, yeah, that 1.5% is right on the money. That's exactly what we think this stock should pay, this preferred stock. So in that case, if I take 60 cents divided by 0.015, I will get, lo and behold, exactly par. The preferred will sell at par. Now, interestingly, when I was looking through those, I found some companies. All of them were real estate types of companies, public companies that were real estate oriented. I went through, and interest rates have fallen a lot. I mean, just down in the dirt. And so these preferred stocks, which were selling, which were paying these dividends of like 0.75%, 1%, 1.25%, they are now selling at a premium to par because interest rates out there in the market are so darn low now that these preferred stock, which used to, you know, that's a really lousy dividend, 1.5%, I can't live on. Now, suddenly, those preferred stocks are gold because they're paying a coupon, they're paying a dividend that is higher than what the market thinks it should be because interest rates have dropped so low. So there's something right there. It's an interesting thing by seeing preferred stock actually going up in price. One thing, though, about preferred stock, and just a final note on that stuff, is that preferred stock is very low risk, comparatively speaking. Preferred stock is something that should, if you're looking for fixed income investments, it's actually something, you know, when you're getting old, you can buy bonds, they're safe, get a nice coupon every 6 months. But preferred stock is something that can go into a portfolio quite nicely on its own as something that's going to pay this fixed dividend every year. You're going to get that dividend. You might get it more than once a year if they divide it up, but one way or the other, It's an investment that most people don't even think about, and most companies wouldn't even consider investment banks. Yeah, they'll do preferred stock offerings. There's an interesting thing I should mention about investment banks. When you do an offering, if you're a company and you do an offering of common stock, they're going to whack you back and forth with fees and percentage of each share they sell. Now, the book, I think, says something like, well, it's going to be about 7%. They're going to have all kinds of extra fees in there. It could be upwards of maybe 10% of the price of a share of stock you're not going to get if you're the company issuing the stock. Interestingly, though, when investment bankers do bonds or preferred stock, oddly enough, the fees are a lot lower for those things. It's like they don't even have to worry about getting buyers working on the book of business, the book building stuff, the sell side and the buy side. It's like there is just a standing market when an investment bank takes care of $100 million in debt that a company wants to issue. The market's right there. And the same would be true on the other side for preferred stock. The fees are very low because there are these ginormous companies that are more than happy to absorb an issue of preferred stock. What kinds of entities do this? Want this, you know, super long term preferred stocks forever. Well, there are companies like insurance companies, life insurance companies, that like those kinds of things. They don't have to worry about ups and downs and the price of it. They don't have to worry about constantly keeping an eye on, do we buy or do we sell? And that's another thing, too. Preferred stock is like bonds in the sense that it is a sluggish market. Bonds and preferred stock don't do those wild up and down and up and down that nearly give you a heart attack from day to day. Bonds and preferred stock, they move, but they move much more sluggishly. It's like the difference between air and thick molasses. In fact, that's one of the things is as you get to a more mature stage in your life cycle, you don't need the aggravation. And I mentioned, well, geez, Zooey, it was like, was it yesterday? I had my portfolio drop by close to $800 in 2 hours. I was down. Today, I'm back up $300. I've recovered $300 of what I lost. But I mean, it's just heart attack material. Now, if you're into stable investments that you don't have to watch every day and you're sweating bullets and you're taking Adderall to keep you on track, well, that's bonds and preferred stock. They're big, big markets, and they move a lot more slowly on price. They're more sluggish. Well, the main reason is because there is a known amount of money coming to you along the way. In bonds, it's the interest, those coupons. In preferred stock, it's that known, fixed, promised dividend. You see, the common shareholders don't have any promise of a dividend. A company can issue it, or it can say, no, we're not going to issue it. Now, of course, if a company has started to issue dividends, and then it says, we can't do it right now, and the market is going to paddle that company. No, bad company. We expected a dividend. You didn't give it. Flock. But so, yeah, dividends, you probably don't want to stop doing dividends, but it's just sort of like one of those things where you don't know for sure that you're going to get a dividend. I mean, even some very reputable companies have, because of how difficult times are, they have had discussions of cutting their dividends. Most companies will do whatever they can not to do that. A company that is old and mature will try its best, even in bad times, to keep that dividend going to the shareholders. And if there's a growth rate of that dividend that they've stabilized over the years, well, they're going to try to keep that growth rate, even if it's hurting the company. Companies are right over the last, one of the things that I noticed that was a warning sign that things were getting a little bit dangerous in the market. Companies were actually in positions where they were losing money at the net income line, but they were still paying their stupid dividends. And they grew the dividend. It's like you could have used that money to push back into the company to do to work on new technologies, new products, not fire workers that have been working for you for a long time. But no, they will do all these things, give up capital investments, give up research and development, give up their seasoned employees who have the body of knowledge of the corporation just so they can get that stupid dividend to their shareholders. So that's anyway, that's enough about dividends on their own. Take that off the board. The worst, one of the worst scenarios is a company where you have unstable dividends. And I showed this in the last lecture. There are companies where there's turbulent times. Every company, when it's young, has its ups and downs. And it might not even pay a dividend for a few years. But at the same time, you know that somewhere down the line, even though some years it doesn't pay dividends, some years it does pay dividends, somewhere down the line, the company is going to stabilize its dividend policy, and then it's going to have a constant growth rate. That's when we can find that horizon value, as it were. And just to give you another one of those, just to make sure that you have this in your knowledge base, suppose we're sitting at year zero on a company. Here's year one, here's year two, here's year three, here's year four, and here's year five and six. Now this company, say that again. It is. Huh. You know why? It's actually trying to focus on me and then go back and forth. It's doing what's called, in my other profession as a professional photographer, it's called focus hunting. It's hunting for focus. I'm wondering what I could, if there's any way that I can get it. Brighter lights would help a lot here. Hang on. I know I'm going to be sorry trying to do this. The brighter the lights, the tighter the aperture, which means you've got a larger depth of field. In other words, a larger focal distance where it won't hunt. So I'm hoping that will help. I've got a light back there. I'm a little afraid of that light because it has tended to kind of like catch things on fire in the past. And I mean, I try to get my rest at night, and when you smell smoke and you have to get up and stop the fire. But anyway, let's see if this will help a little bit. Let me also do something else here. No! Oh, that's me. Jeez, oy. God, that nose is horrible. Why? How did that? Anyway. Yeah, there. It's a little closer. I don't like all this glare. I'm going to have to work on that. Get something a little better for the next time. But okay, and I'll read this. I've got a timeline going years 0 through 6. Now, in year 0, Mother of God, Joe Biden's demon, someone just popped on the screen with a... am I being Zoom bombed? Anyway, okay. So let's say in year one, they're going to pop off a nice little dividend of 50 cents a share. And then in year two, we'll get you hooked up. We'll get a dividend 10 cents a share. Year three, nope, you're not going to get a nada. You're going to get nada in year three. We got things to do with our money in year three, zero. But in year four, yeah, we're going to get you a nice dividend of 30 cents a share. And then in year five, we're going to put forward a dividend of 40 cents a share. And then we're going to forever after that grow the dividend at, let's say, 4%. We get to the constant growth rate part. So in other words, the dividend in year six will be 40 cents times 1.06, 1 plus the growth rate. So that means that the dividend will be 42.4 cents. If I did that right. Yeah. And again, I want to emphasize, just do it this way. I can use the constant growth rate model. The value right here of all the future dividends from that point forward will be the D1, which is 5 plus 1, 6.424, divided by the cost of capital here. We'll say that the WACC here is Oh, 8%, let's do 8%. 8%, 0.08, minus the growth rate of 0.06. So in other words, the value here at year 5 of the entire cash flow forever after that is going to be, again, 0.424. The dividend at year 6, that's D6, over their weighted average cost of capital minus 0.06. If you do that, you find you find 0.424 times 1.06. Oops. No, I already did that. Clear. Let's try that again. 0.424, I already did the 1.06, divided by 0.08 minus 0.06, which is 0.02. So the horizon value there at year 5, this is called the horizon value of this company, is $21.20. That's the horizon value. The rest of it is just cranking out. You're going to find the present value of each of these unstable dividends. Which would be 50 cents divided by 1 plus that 0.08, the discount rate, to the negative first, plus 10 cents times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative second, plus nothing, zero, times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative third, plus 30 cents, 0.30, times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative fourth, plus, now you bring back the horizon value, plus the $21.20 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative fifth. No. Oh, God. Don't anyone breathe. This thing is about to come down. It came down this morning and blasted my coffee all over everything. And my cats went flying around trying to get out of the room. There. Okay, now let me read that to you in case this board isn't giving you a good visual. I'm going to discount back the 50 cents 1 year at 8%. So we got 0.50 times 1.08 to the negative first, plus the 10 cent dividend, 0.10 times 1.08 to the negative second, bring it back 2 years, plus no dividend in year 3, times 1.08 to the negative third, that's trivial, we wouldn't even do that one, plus the 0.30, the dividend in year 4, times 1.08 to the negative fourth, and then you add in the present value of that horizon value that happens at year 5, $21.20 times 1.08 to the negative fifth. Now, if I can actually do that without making a mistake during the calculation of it, I would have the 50 cent dividend, 0.5 times 1.08, and you can, I'm doing this just so you have it in your notes, to the negative first, 1 pos neg, plus, I said plus, where I can't even read my own screen, plus the dividend 10 cents, 0.10, times 1.08 y to the x negative second 2 pos neg. Now I'm going to ignore that third year because it's trivial. Plus the fourth year dividend 0.30 times 1.08 y to the x 4 pos neg plus the $21.20 times 1.08 to the negative fifth. And I'm hoping that I come out with the right answer here, equals $15.20, rounded to dollars and cents. So in other words, the value of this corporation to by our dividend growth model is $15.20. That would be that all-important thing, the intrinsic value. Is that going to be the stock price? Probably not. But if I think this model is good for finding the intrinsic value on this company, then I will say if the stock right now is selling at, let's say, $14 a share, then that would be a buy because right now the market is underpricing, undervaluing the stock. So I would bring that into my portfolio because I have a good, reasonable expectation that the price will move toward its intrinsic value over a period of time. This isn't short swing trading. This is longer term. Now, if I saw that the stock was selling at, I had it in my portfolio, and this stock is right now at $18 a share, oh, I would dump that very fast. I just collect. Look, it's overvalued. It's going to come down toward its intrinsic value. So let me sell this now so that I can make my money off it and then just watch it drop after that. This is what we do in longer-term investing is these analyses of the possible value over a long period of time of a stock. No, the price is $18 now, but I have a reasonable scientific basis for my expectation that that price is higher than the long-term price of the stock is, so I would dump it from my portfolio if I had it in there. Otherwise, if I don't have it in there, I just stay the hell away from it. I just don't put it in. Boy, that's an $18 stock. I'll bet I might put some of that. Well, let's do the analysis. Oh, whoa, that is way over intrinsic value. No, move on to something else. Just keep searching around. You will find the winners. And this goes back, and I mentioned this in the last lecture, and I've bitched about this company before. It's like Tesla, for God's sake. Tesla was clearly overvalued with respect to its intrinsic value. Most models that were run on Tesla found that its true stock price was probably around $200 a share, if that. The rest of it was pure hype and fluff and expectations that this company was going to do things that it really probably wasn't going to do. The reality of it was, if you break down the company Tesla, look at its free cash flows. The first thing you notice is that the free cash flow is terrible. It's negative. The second thing you notice is, okay, this company actually is alive. Well, that's a good thing. But how? Oh, it's that other side of the business that no one seems to talk about. This company isn't a winner because of its cars. They're pretty. They're cool. This company is a winner because of its electric generating technologies. And that is, value those, and you're getting about $200 to $250, maybe a little more generous, $270 per share. So when it got up there into the stratosphere at $700-$800 a share, all it took was a market shakeup for everyone and his mother to sell that stock down and drop it even probably below its intrinsic value, which is what's probably happened now. But there was no doubt about it that if you had Tesla in your portfolio at $700-$800 a share and you did the analysis and you didn't go with the hype and the emotion, you saw that it was time long ago to get that stock out of your portfolio. And never mind the shows, the flashy shows that are done with this beautiful cars and all this kind of stuff. Don't let that kind of stuff move you if you're a hardcore long-term investor. Look for real value, not makeup and pretty things and beard cream, all that. Underneath everything that I'm talking about, this R, value of a stock or a bond, there is a part of that, the largest part of all of this is risk. As risk goes up, stock prices, bond prices, whatever you want to talk about, they will go the opposite way. Risk drives prices down. If you have a chance for, if you could invest in a very risky stock, you probably know inside of yourself that it would be stupid to pay a very high price for it, because there is that risk is driving the value, the possible outcome. Now, that's an important thing to consider, is that, okay, we have a great deal of risk. We expect a higher return. Well, how do you get a higher return with greater risk? You drive down the price at which you buy it. Then, if it does come through, pay off, the price will pop high in the air. But if you already paid a high price, then that would be foolish to do. I need to get one more little round here out about risk. Talk about it in a more... just get that into your minds. First of all, risk is not a single thing. Risk arises from a number of different different parts. There is risk that is inherent to a company itself. It's not part of the risk of all companies. It's just that company's risk. Crazy management. Odd products that this company tries and then fails and then tries something else. Unusual ways of corporate governance, perhaps. Even things that are just kind of like just peculiar to that company. Those kinds of risks, all we do is we just diversify away, get rid of them, by buying other companies. And every company is going to have its peculiarities, and we want those to cancel each other out. That's what that whole correlation coefficient is all about. The lower the correlation between two companies' stock prices, the more they are going to cancel out each other's company risk. It's unsystematic risk. It's diversifiable risk. It's peculiar risk. And so that's why we diversify. But we also look at risk in other regards too. Risk can come from other places. For example, one thing that is a killer on risk, one thing that creates risk, is fixed costs. You see, if costs are variable, then they just, revenues go down, those costs go down. Revenues go up, those costs go up. But if it's a fixed cost, it is there forever. Revenues go down, you still have to pay that cost. Revenues go up, you pay that cost. And that is a problem. That's one of the big dangers of taking on debt, because you have to pay those debt holders their interest payments. If you don't, they'll shut you down. So that risk is greater. That interest expense is a fixed cost. On the other hand, your wholesale prices that you pay for your goods are really more of a variable cost, because those you buy a lot when your revenues go up. You don't buy as much when revenues go down. So they move with the revenues. They're variable costs. So you always want to keep in mind that anytime you see a fixed cost, that presents a risk. This has become very well understood in the last 5 years, maybe a little more than that. You see, back in the old days, more than five years ago, I'll point out, companies would sell shrink wrap software. You bought it, and then it was yours. You see, to a company, that means that they produce an inventory, a physical inventory. But then companies began to follow a model that had actually been deployed some years before in the antivirus software community with Norton Antivirus and others like that. They have you pay a subscription that renews every year. What that does is that moves the fixed cost from the company to its subscribers, to its customers. Then it's your problem as the buyer of the subscription to keep your subscription payments going. They know the company no longer has that fixed cost. They've moved the risk to you. The first company, one of the first companies to do it was Adobe, and it was kind of scary. Other companies said, whoa, this is... And then with their Photoshop, you guys can't buy a physical product that you own forever from Adobe. You have to buy a subscription. You don't pay the subscription fee. It goes away, and then all the things you've done that have an Adobe basis, everything from PDFs on through to Photoshop PSDs and all those other things in the different applications, you don't get them anymore. You are stuck with a fixed cost. You carry the risk. This has gotten so popular now that there is actually a huge backlash. Every company wants you to pay your bill online every month. You don't have to worry about it. We'll just put a sucker on your bank account and take your money out. And there are people who are just simply saying, no, I don't want that anymore. I've already got things taking my money out every month. Netflix is doing it. These other services, subscription services. You see, they want you to wear risk. And more risk, the more and more things to which you subscribe. Your internet service, your entertainment, Hulu or Disney Plus or whatever it is you want. All of them want you to... They won't let you have it unless you bear this fixed cost for the rest of your lives. You're never going to get out from under. And then, of course, if they have a problem, they need more money, all they're going to do is just say, oh, we just upped your subscription fee. What are you going to do about it, suckers? So there's another one. Another source of risk is fixed costs. Now there's another one even. This one is time. Time is a risk dimension. Remember, risk is the possibilities of outcomes. If there aren't many possible outcomes, or if they're all very much in a tight pack, low risk. But when there are more possible outcomes, well, that's higher risk. Time does this. Let me show you an example of how time... More time creates more risk. See this? Johnson's baby powder. Now you're saying, oh, wait a minute, how is this related to risk? Well, we're going to take a physical dimension and we are going to call that time. Now watch what happens. With a short amount of time, a little bit of distance, watch. Not many different places, right? See? Time. However, if we take time and we extend it way out to here, watch what happens. You see? Look. God. More risk, because there's, see all the, I didn't even know, they came more outcomes and they weren't even where I expected them to be. Time is that way. It creates more possibilities and it creates possibilities where you might not have even been able to predict. Wait. Oh. Okay. You see the point. Time creates risk. Wait, give me a minute here. The more you wait, the more possibilities there are. And that is what, that's risk. So in other words, and another thing, I'm going to hold this investment for one day. Well, there's not a whole lot of places it can go, although God knows yesterday it went a whole lot of places. But I'm going to hold this investment for 30 years. Well, there are a whole lot more outcomes that could happen in those 30 years. You might decide that you want to have a friend for a day. Well, how much danger can there be in a day? But suppose that you decide to have that person as a friend over 30 years. All kinds of things. The person could turn out to have, at the full moon, he turns into a werewolf. Or the person, after 15 years, develops some kind of mental illness and starts doing weird things, burning down your house. See, the longer you hold something, the more there is the likelihood that something you don't expect will happen. That, for example, this, all over, my nose itches so bad right now. You see, this happened. I didn't even expect, I thought it was going to land right here in the middle, and it was going to be a nice pattern here. No, it was here, it was here, it was in my coffee tastes funny now. Do you know, have you ever had baby powder in coffee? It's awful. It's just awful. But I am so hooked on coffee, I'll use it. Enough of that. The last thing about all of this The very last thing to bring up tonight, this is really scaring me because this thing, wait. This is going to be a disaster if I don't solve this quickly here. Okay. The last way that we can value companies, and again, I've talked about this in other venues. Some companies don't have any stock outstanding. They don't pay dividends yet. They're just not that kind of companies. That does not mean that we just don't worry about valuing. Well, we better worry about it if those companies do want to go public. We got to figure out a price for that stock for the offering. And another thing is, if we want to be private investors, we have to figure out the value of the company to figure out what our ownership is. If they're going to sell us 20% ownership in the company, we need to know the value of that company, the value of the equity in that company, so that we can make reasonable assumptions about what that value, that 10%, 20%, whatever you're going to buy is. And that comes back to the issue that I brought up about risk, is because part of that valuation process simply has to be questions that are deeply connected to risk. How long is it going to be before this company is profitable? No, I don't expect to invest in young companies that are profitable already. That's part of the game. You're a risk taker. But when will I expect a profit? When will I expect dividends? When will I expect you to go public so you can register my stock so I can get out of this investment? Those kinds of questions, we need to answer those with private companies. In these countries that, with whom I'm working for, they want to invest in small companies that have a potential to create employment in the country, the potential to make tourists come to the country or make other businesses come to the country because they hear about these businesses growing. And so the government says, we want to raise money for ourselves, and then we will invest in, we'll choose 20 companies, 20 small private companies, and we will invest in them. We'll put in money, and we'll make a rule, 10 years, and then we spin off, we we get the company public, and then we spin off our stake in it. So the government is in there, not for completely for charitable reasons. The government wants to make investments that are going to pay off in one way or another. Hence why, that's why, where the hell was I? Oh, we can always drill down to free cash flow. The free cash flow to the company. Now remember that the free cash flow is going to be the NOPAT plus, you add back the depreciation because that never actually happened, minus the capital expenditures, which really did happen, and then minus the change in net operating working capital. This year's working capital minus last year's working capital. So in other words, if you added inventory, that would make the working capital go up, which would be a cash drain. If you depleted inventory or you collected your some accounts receivable, that would add cash flow, etc. So there's your free cash flow. Now what we can do is we can estimate the free cash flows for a period of years and just do what I did with that dividend growth model. Okay, the free cash flows are going to be unstable for the first 6 years. And then at year six, the free cash flows will stabilize to a constant growth. We can do the same thing we did with dividends, except the numerator is going to be free cash flows. Find the horizon value and then bring back the unstable parts as present values, and then that one, that horizon value as a single lump back, and we've got a value of the company right there. That's, and I mean, quite, that was what, as a matter of fact, in the last time we had some representatives from the Ministry of Finance of a West African country, and I was going through, we're teaching this, the Western ways of the Western model, the Western capitalist model, so that they can attract capital because they are learning how we do it in this developed world. And then that gives more confidence to the heavies in international investment, like the Chinese, the Saudis, even the Russians, the Canadians, some of the Europeans. It gives them confidence. These people are learning how it's done in the best practices places in the world. And so I teach them. That's what I teach them, is just find the free cash flow. We go through different examples, and then we just lay it out on a timeline, unstable, but we're predicting, and then we figure at year five, it'll stabilize, and then we can find the current value, and then of the company, and the present value, what it's worth now, and then what would be a reasonable amount for the government to invest for a certain percentage in that, and get that expected rate of return, that R. That's how we do it. Now, there are a couple of other things that you could talk about as far as that goes. One, I am so afraid to let go of this stupid mirror, of this stupid or now. One thing. Enterprise value. I mean, this is actually fairly popular. And in fact, I'm going to show you on Monday where you can actually get these numbers for companies. They're already pre-calculated. Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage calculates all of this stuff for you. It does the work so we don't have to anymore, but we still have to show it to you simply because it's best if you know how those numbers are generated. Now, enterprise value, you take the market value of the equity. Now, that's a fancy way of saying take the market cap, that number that's right there on Yeehaw Finance at the top, plus the market value of debt plus the market value of other obligations minus the cash and cash equivalents. Now, let me say this. The market value of the equity is just the price per share times the number of shares outstanding, the market cap. The market value of debt, if a company has, let's say a company has $50 million on its books. Well, if that debt in the bond market is selling at exactly par, well, then that book value would be the market value. But if that market value, if the bonds, that $50 million in bonds, let's say it's selling at $1,020, or what we say, 102 to the 100, then the market value of debt isn't $50 million. It's $50 million times 1.02. Because the market's saying that debt is worth 2% more than its book value. So what you would, and this gets really pain in the ass complicated, though, because most companies have lots of different kinds of debt. Senior, senior subordinated, junior, what? So realistically, what we usually do, we just look at the book, take the book value of debt. In real practice, we say the hell with that. We're just going to look at the book value. It's got to be, unless the company's in serious trouble, the book value is probably pretty close to the market value anyway. Now, the market value of other obligations, the company's going to have, there again, you look at the balance sheet, okay, they've got these leases, they've got these wages payable, they've got some taxes payable. Those are pretty much going to be book value. In other words, just look at the financial statement, the balance sheet for those. And then the cash, you just subtract off that from the balance sheet. So in other words, real world, you look at the market cap. And then you go down here and you look at the book. What does the balance sheet say, the value of all the long-term debt? Then you look at all the other liabilities that they have. Put those down. And then you subtract off the cash because the cash is not part of enterprise value. It can go away too quickly. And there you can have the enterprise value of a company. So that's all I have for you tonight as I stand here and do my final pose so that I've got a final shot going into the credit roll at the end. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.